From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The story of Western water seems complicated when you think about water compacts and water law, but Daniel Beard says it's not complicated. In his new book, he says Obamacare is complicated, your phone bill is complicated, but Western water is not. It's just one of the myths perpetuated by what he calls the water nobility, a group of interests who receive water from federal dams and have come to feel entitled. Here's what you need to know, he says. Billions of dollars and billions of gallons of water are being wasted. Beard has written a book where he lays out his case for drastically reforming Western water policy, and one of his ideas is to abolish the Bureau of Reclamation. Did I mention he used to be in charge of the Bureau? He'll join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There has been a lot written about Western water, hundreds of books and articles and posts. But Daniel Beard says he noticed more often than not the people doing the writing were pulling their punches. So when he decided to write his own book about the subject, he was determined to tell the truth as he saw it in the most candid way he could think of. The proof of that is the subtitle of his book, Why We Should Abolish the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and Tear Down the Glen Canyon Dam. But those are just two of the ideas he proposes for reforming Western water policy, which he describes as an archaic and inefficient distribution system that doesn't meet the needs of a modern West. In his book, Beard says it's time to chart a new course. And today in the program, he's joining us to explain what he means. The book, again, Deadbeat Dams, Why We Should Abolish the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and Tear Down Glen Canyon Dam. You can join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Daniel Beard served as commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation under President Clinton. He's worked on water issues in both the government and the private sector. He's served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Land and Water Resources. He's also been a Senior Vice President of the National Audubon Society. He's in Utah this week with speaking engagements around the state. We'll give you details about all of those as we go along. And Daniel Beard, welcome to you. Thanks very
much. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here, Doug.
I want to begin with a story that you tell in your book. You begin with this moment. There was a gathering in Las Vegas a few years ago, the Colorado River Water Users Association. And on the dais up there were other former commissioners of the Bureau of Reclamation. You were among them.
Mm-hmm.
And you had what you describe as kind of benign remarks prepared. You were going to play nice, I guess, is maybe the way to put it. But for some reason, you decided at some point, Daniel Beard, to set those remarks aside and kind of, and this is how you put it in the book, speak from your heart.
Well, it was an epiphany for me. I was sitting there with four other former commissioners and listening to the speeches drone on. And as I looked at the audience, I kind of lost my cool. I began to get upset. And what made me mad is that if the public only knew what a good deal some of these folks are getting, they would be outraged. And that led me to set my benign remarks aside and decide to speak from the heart. And I basically said, look, you folks are getting a good deal, and the public doesn't know about it, and we ought to do something about this. That was my view.
Yeah.
And once I left Las Vegas and returned home, I decided to look for someone to write a book about that. And I started calling people and sending emails and reaching out to friends and colleagues. And long story short, couldn't find anybody that was interested.
Yeah.
And I thought at that point, well, this is easy. I can write a book about it.
I know a lot about this. I'll do it.
Yeah. And people have done that all the time. It must be easy. Everybody else does it. Well, it's a long process, and it's a difficult process, and it's a challenging one. Yeah. And so I went through all the throes of trying to put something like this together. It's taken a few years, but it's been a wonderful experience.
How did you know right from the beginning that the idea was you were going to say the difficult things? I mean, I guess that was the point of it, right, for you?
I didn't see any point in just writing another water book. I mean, the shelves are filled with them. We've got acres and acres of books on water issues. We've got national commissions that have looked at water policy issues from every perspective, and they've been done over the last 50 years. And so writing just another book about water in a kind of water wonkies style just sort of struck me as a waste of time because nobody would read it. And what I needed to do was to write about my experiences, what I experienced, and how my perceptions and views had been shaped by my experiences, and try to write it in a way where it was readable for the general public. That was probably the biggest challenge.
This is one of the myths that you write about, actually, that you say is perpetuated by what you call water nobility. And we'll get to sort of defining what you mean by that. But this myth that this is a complicated issue, it's wonkish. I mean, you look at a document about a water compact, and it seems crazy Byzantine. But that seems like the thing that really bothers you. This idea, you say it's not that complicated. I mean, that's one of the myths that you try to kind of break away.
Well, the frustration that I've always had is that the experts, if you can call them that, have a refrain that they use, which is, this is a very complicated issue. You better leave it to us. Well, the moment anybody says that to you, you better hold on to your wallet because they're about ready to take some money from you. And that's one of the things that's happened in the water world. Yes, it's there's a complicated water law regime, and it's different in every state. Yeah. And it's a little different at the national level. But the reality is that our water laws are designed to assist agriculture and mining and those who came first. If you got here first and you got a water right, then you get to keep it forever. And it's a great system for people like that. It's a terrible system if you happen to be an environmentalist or you're an American Indian. You got to take it away from you. So what we have is a complicated legal system, but the reality is it's designed and it's perpetuated as complex, and we're told that it's complex because people don't want you to really look at what's going on. Once we shine the bright light of public opinion and public understanding on these issues, they become a little bit clearer and easier to understand. And I feel the water nobility has loved this idea of cloaking things in secrecy, not revealing what's really going on, and that way they can perpetuate the grip that they have on the water policy faucet and public funds.
You've been in this field for nearly 40 years now, water policy. As you say in the book, you've been in practically all of the positions in water policy in the country. What draws someone into this field? What is the thing that got you interested at first in water?
I honestly don't know. I had a professor at the University of Washington where I went to graduate school, and he taught a course on the water resources of the Pacific Northwest, and I found it fascinating. I'm not quite sure why I found it fascinating, and much of what he talked about even remains with me today. And then through a curious set of circumstances, when I went to work at the for President Carter in the White House on the domestic policy staff, He had issued a hit list to try to, eliminate funding for a bunch of water projects. And I was thrown into the maelstrom of the controversy. And then I went over to the Interior Department as a Deputy Assistant Secretary. And they were looking around the room and said, well, who are we going to have work on water? And I guess my hand didn't go up fast enough to say I couldn't do it. So I was assigned the task. And I've been at it ever since.
You say America is facing a water crisis. Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
Well, there are two things going on at the present time that are shaping the debate about water. The first is what the scientists refer to as a mega drought. We're in the 15th year of a drought in the Colorado River Basin and in California. And it is the worst drought we've had in 1,000 years. And this is beginning to really have an impact on supplies for many communities and for many institutions that receive water. So we have a mega drought going on. But at the same time, we are beginning to feel the effects of climate change. Rainfall or the precipitation patterns will change going forward. What's going to happen is we're going to have less snow. And we will have our precipitation will come in the form of rain, and it'll probably come easier or different times of the year. So the system that we've built in the West, which is primarily to capture runoff from snow, is not going to be terribly useful going forward. Yeah. There may be portions of our infrastructure that will just be virtually worthless because we're going to have a change in the way that water, the way we capture water and use water.
I wanted to get a sense of you. This is interesting. You write about one of your ideas, of course, is to just let's abolish the Bureau of Reclamation, minor agency as you describe it, 550 employees or so.
5,500.
5,500, sorry. That is small. That is minor. But crucial, you say, in the growth of cities in the West, that especially cities that would have been limited because of water. Las Vegas, of course, and Phoenix and Los Angeles. I'm guessing Salt Lake City you could throw into that mix as well. And you say that the Bureau can be credited with helping establish agriculture, in fact, California Central and Imperial Valleys. So there's the really important impact on the West from the Bureau of Reclamation. But then you also write about the counter side to that, the environmental impact, destroying hundreds of miles of rivers, free-flowing rivers, promoting excessive water use, all of those kinds of things. At what point did you realize, you were at the head of this organization, at what point did you realize the negative parts outweighed the positive ones?
Well, look, the Bureau of Reclamation was created to perform a certain function. It was created to help settle the West. Well, they succeeded. And it was also created because there wasn't a residual or a place where we had a residual of engineering talent and expertise to be able to build water projects and canals and things like this. And it was logical to create that at the federal level. Today, the level of engineering expertise we have in the private sector with local entities and with state entities far outshines what we have in the federal government. And in fact, the federal government contracts with private industry to build all of its facilities today. So the two original reasons that the Bureau was established are no longer relevant. Now you come to the question of, well, why do we keep them?
Yeah.
Why are they there today? And you've got to turn yourself into a pretzel to come up with some reasons as to why we want to do this. The Bureau doesn't do anything that somebody else can't do and do it just as well. For example, they operate Grand Coulee Dam, Hoover Dam, and so forth. They operate the generating stations there. But the generating stations can be operated by private utilities. And in fact, Hoover Dam was operated for the first 50 years of its existence by the Southern California Edison Company. So So we don't need them to operate those facilities. We probably need federal officials to turn the water spigots, but the water that does flow flows to local entities who distribute it. So once again, it's the Bureau has, at this point, I wander around and I say to myself, why do we have them? One of the compelling reasons we should have them is we need leadership on solving these problems, the problems associated with drought and climate change. But the Bureau has demonstrated over the last 2 decades that it is simply unwilling to step up and provide that leadership.
Because of, and this is a crucial issue in the book, politics. That's one of them. Would you tell that story about Pete Domenici? It's a great story because I think that he asked you this question. I don't think you had been the commissioner of the Bureau that long when you met with the senator from New Mexico. And he asked you that point blank, that question you asked, why do we need a Bureau of Reclamation?
Well, when you're appointed to a federal position that requires Senate confirmation, and the commissioner of reclamation does, you're required to go on what they call courtesy calls. So you wander around and introduce yourself to all the senators that are on the committee that's going to hear your nomination. And Senator Domenici was one of those senators. And he was a very informed and really bright guy. I really enjoyed my conversation with him. But he had been elected and worked his way up in the seniority ranks from New Mexico. And so I went in to see him and introduced myself, and he was signing a large stack of letters, and he said, while I sign these letters, let me ask you a question. Why do we need the Bureau of Reclamation? And I was kind of thunderstruck for a second and stumbled around, and then I said, you know, Senator, we don't. They don't do anything that can't be done by somebody else. But let me ask you a question. Would you like to be known as a senator who got rid of the Bureau of Reclamation? And he stopped signing the letters, put down his pen, looked up at me and smiled and said, good answer. And I think it was, because it really demonstrated to me and drove home the point that when you talk about Western water issues, you're talking about politics and not policy. And there's a real difference, because water issues, no matter what problem or budget or solution you look at, we don't approach water issues in an unbiased and detached manner. It's always permeated by politics. And that's just a reality that you have to accept if you want to get into this field and start working on these issues.
One of the things that, and we'll get back to this a little bit later, but one of the things you talk about in terms of if you abolish the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, what you put in place is something like the Base Realignment Commission, I think it's called. In other words, make it politically independent. Don't make it beholden to political interests in Congress. Separate that part.
Well, the Base Realignment and Closure Commission is an absolutely fascinating example of government getting it right, if you will. You know, at the end of the Cold War, we found ourselves with all these military bases and shipyards, and everyone agreed, on the right and left of the political spectrum, everyone agreed we had too many bases and we had to close some. Well, the question was, how do we make that decision? Now, at the time that the law, first closure commission was created, Congressman O'Neill was the Speaker of the House and from Boston, and he sure wasn't going to get rid of the Boston shipyard. So it just went on and on and on. With every senator, every congressman, it was exactly the same thing. But what Congress did was that they created a commission. It's presidentially appointed. It's charged with the responsibility to come up with a list of bases and shipyards to close and to consolidate. And that list is then presented to the president. He has only two choices, yes or no. Yeah. And it's then sent to the House and Senate. And it's, again, no amendments allowed, no side deals, no earmarks, just yes or no. And there have been six BRAC rounds, and we've closed hundreds, thousands of bases, consolidated our forces, and we've saved billions of dollars in the process. My feeling about funding water projects is everyone knows about the I scratch your back, you scratch mine form of politics we practice with water project funding. We've all heard of the phrase pork barrel, which is used to designate, you know, funding for water projects. And as hard as they try, members of Congress simply can't get around this issue, and they can't get away from this game. So my suggestion is we establish a commission along the lines of the Base Realignment and Closure Commission, and have our funding priorities for the next 5 years determined by this commission. Send it to the president. He can approve it or disapprove it. Send it to the Congress, the same thing. And then we'll get the politics out of it. And what we'll do then is we'll get a much more rational allocation of scarce resources, scarce tax dollars that we have. Right now, it's the system is it's a fascinating one. It's if I won't oppose your project if you won't oppose my project. And when in the judicial world, in the criminal world, we call this either bribery or collusion. But in the water world, we call it good politics. You know, I'm going to get mine, and the only way I get it is I ignore yours. Even though you know something's a waste of money, you look the other way and you're rewarded for it. And I just think it's wrong.
That's another problem you mentioned. You say logic and common sense seldom play a role in resolving water problems. And you tell another story. It's full of good stories, I have to say, the book, where you illustrate this issue, this problem. It's the story of the Hoover Dam Visitor Center. Did you tell that story?
Well, I was appointed by President Clinton, confirmed by the Senate, and my first day on the job, I took a little cardboard box of my possessions down to the new office, put it down, and about 20 minutes later, a friend of mine called me. He says, "Great news. He's a lobbyist." And he said, "I've got a new client." I said, "Oh, great. Who's the client?" And he said, it's a community. It was actually a community of, Pahrump, Nevada, near Las Vegas. And I said, "Oh, good. Who are you going to lobby?" He says, "You." And I said, "Over what?" And he said, "Well, it seems that their power rates are going to be quadrupled because the Bureau of Reclamation spent $100 million on a visitor center." Now,
Say that again. $100 million.
Yes.
On a visitor center.
That's right. That was my reaction.
Right.
I practically fell over and I said, "Well, first of all, that's just impossible because they had just completed construction of the Holocaust Museum on the National Mall. And they didn't spend $100 million on that, I'll tell you." So I said, "Look, I'll look into this." So I called in my deputy at the time, and he said, "No, it couldn't have happened. But I'll look into it." And he came back. And he came back, and he was staring at his shoes. And I think for anybody who's in management, when the folks you've asked to give you some information start staring at their shoes, you know you've got trouble. He said, "Well, I've got good news and bad news." And I said, "Okay, well, let's start with the good." And he said, "Well, the good news is it isn't going to cost us $100 million. I said, "Well, that's good." He says, "No, our estimate now is it'll cost us $108 million. And in fact, it went up to $125 million. And what this demonstrated to me when I heard about it, I was appalled. And I said to myself, how on earth could they have lost sight of common sense? You know, all you're asking for is a visitor center. And we needed a facility there. There were millions of people who go to Hoover Dam, and it was unsafe with people walking around on the top of the dam. But you didn't need to build a monument. And you certainly didn't need to build a monument for $125 million. So I decided that the best thing I could do is blow the whistle on it. And I brought every news reporter I could find out there and pointed to it and said, this is a waste of money and we shouldn't do this ever again. I incurred the wrath of most of the Bureau of Reclamation employees as a result. They hated the idea I was trying to, they thought, embarrass them. But what I was trying to do was drive home a point, which is we needed a visitor center and we didn't approach this in a very logical, common sense fashion, but instead we decided to build a monument. And if anything could go wrong with the construction, it did in that particular case. But $125 million for a visitor center is just an unbelievable amount of money.
Daniel Beard is with us. His book is called Deadbeat Dams, Why We Should Abolish the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and Tear Down Glen Canyon Dam. He is tonight at 7 o'clock. He's giving a reading at Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City. He's also going to be speaking tomorrow night at the University of Utah as a guest of the Glen Canyon Institute. He's going to be in Moab on Thursday, Provo on Friday. We have all of the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are talking about water in the West. Daniel Beard is with us. He used to be head of the Bureau of Reclamation. It's an agency responsible for water projects, for building dams. Well, Beard has surveyed the water situation in the West for a long time, as a matter of fact, and he's concluded it's time to do away with the Reclamation Bureau. And not only that, he says it's also time to tear down the Glen Canyon Dam. Beard is in Utah this week. He's joining us to give us his perspective and his ideas about water policy in the modern West. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. What do you mean by water nobility?
Well, it was a term that I coined as I thought about those who receive water from federal dams. And I had an experience in Klamath Falls, Oregon, where I went to speak, and as I was speaking and a crowd was yelling at me because they weren't getting as much water as they wanted, it dawned on me that these are really wonderful people, and yet they have been receiving a significant benefit from the taxpayers of this country, and they don't appreciate it. And they began to refer to the water that was being delivered to them by the federal taxpayers at subsidized rates as their water. And it suddenly dawned on me that they have taken possession of this water and they have begun to think of themselves as noble. The best thing you can do with your water and your taxpayer dollars is give it to us. We deserve it. For many years, they were grateful recipients of a federal program, and they were provided with subsidized water so they could grow crops and live a good life and a very economic life. But at some point, something changed, and they began to view these entitlements as these benefits as an entitlement. And in my view, they've bamboozled politicians into thinking that they should continue to receive federal funds in perpetuity, and they should maintain permanent control of water in the West. I think that's wrong. And these are public resources, public funds, and the public ought to shape policies, not a very small number of people who are backed up by their lawyers and engineers and some of their favored politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, because I'm not trying to pick one side or the other here.
What do you mean by subsidized? I think you point out in the book, yeah. It takes us a dollar to develop water that we give away for pennies, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, we deliver water and we may charge $10 an acre foot for that water to a farmer, but it cost us $120 to get it to that farmer. Well, that $110, the difference between those two is the subsidy. Yeah. And in many cases, it's substantial. The total program subsidy was calculated probably last time 20 years ago, and it was over $113 billion. Just one farming, the largest irrigation district in the United States is in California, and the yearly subsidy there is $110 million. Well, you know, that breaks out to about $4 million per farm. And this is a check that we write them every February or April 15th, every year, year after year after year after year. And this is in perpetuity. And it's, you know, they're wonderful people. They're, you know, I have a lot of compassion for them. But you know what? It's time that we wrested control back of that water and began to make public decisions with it.
I want to go through a couple of myths that you say the water nobility has been able to perpetuate over time. First is this idea that there's a direct relationship between the growth in population and the need for more water. You say mm-hmm. that's false.
Yeah. Everybody, you know, every expert will tell you that. What's happened in the last 25 years is that we're using less water on a national level. Because we've instituted a number of changes in the efficiency with which we use water. But there's no direct correlation between the amount of the total population and the amount of water we need. Yes, if you double the population, you will probably need more water. But it doesn't mean that you have to build more reservoirs. It just means that you may have to deliver a small amount more. But you have such potential for conservation and reduction of use that you may, in fact, not have to deliver more water. So California studies have shown over the last 20 years that in many cases they're using less water today than they did 20 years ago with a larger population.
Another myth is that water is needed for agriculture, you know, to meet the food needs of the mm-hmm. country.
Sure.
That's also a myth, you say.
It's absolutely false. About 80 to 85% of water that is consumptively consumed on a state level is consumed by agriculture. The vast majority of that, two-thirds to 75%, is to grow forage for cattle and for export. So it certainly isn't for the production of, you know, crops that are then moved into the food system. The challenge in agriculture over the last 75 years has never been we don't have enough. The challenge in all of our agricultural policies is we produce too much. You know, we're constantly trying to deal with surpluses of dairy products, surpluses of corn and wheat. And here we are with a federal program that is subsidizing people. We're delivering water to people. We're encouraging them to promote production in agriculture when, in fact, we don't want more produced on some of those fields. So it's a totally illogical system. So the myth that they've tried to perpetuate over the years is we need this water
for the good American,
you know,
farmer.
For the good of American stomachs. You know, we're producing food and fiber for the nation, and you need to continue to supply water to us at reduced rates.
There's another myth kind of related to that, and that is that this myth, you say that most of the water in Western communities is used for golf courses and swimming pools. I mean, you know, you hear a lot of people bitching about, you know, golf courses in St. George or Las Vegas or whatever it might be. But that's a myth, you say.
You know, first of all, only about 10 to 15% of water consumed within a given state is consumed by what we call the municipal industrial sector, which is, you know, our communities. Two-thirds of all the water that's used by any resident is outdoor water. And, you know, when Steve Wynn built the big, gigantic fountain that catches on fire every night, it was just, you know, I talked to some of my friends who really aren't interested in these issues, and I say I'm working on water issues, and they say, oh, have you ever been to Las Vegas and seen that, you know, fountain that catches on fire. God, that's really something. And I always sort of hang my head and think, oh, geez, do I have to explain this again, that that's actually gray water? It's water that's reused. You know, it isn't potable water. I go through the whole thing. But it is a myth that some of those very symbolic uses of water for turf purposes catch people's imagination. They look at it, they say, well, that's obviously we're wasting it. And yes, we probably are, but we're wasting just as much or more out on a field here growing hay or alfalfa. So
when we get back from a break, I want to talk about what you say is this growing idea, which seemed not that long ago, it seemed provocative and sort of impossible almost, the idea of removing dams. This is a big part of your book. We'll talk about it when we get back from a break. Daniel Beard is with us. This book is called Deadbeat Dams, Why We Should Abolish the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and Tear Down Grand Canyon Dam. Tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, he's going to be giving a reading at Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City. Tomorrow night at the University of Utah, he'll be a guest of the Glen Canyon Institute speaking on the campus. He's also going to be in Moab on Thursday and in Provo on Friday. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Daniel Beard is joining us. He's former commissioner of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, and one of his ideas in his book, Deadbeat Dams, is abolishing the Bureau, also tearing down Glen Canyon Dam. Daniel Beard is joining us. He's going to be in Utah throughout the week, and there are a number of events he's going to be speaking at, and we'll give you details about that a little bit later in the program. So you tell this story that involves former Utah Congressman James Hansen. This was a hearing back in 1997. And the idea that environmentalists had, and this is the reason the congressman decided to hold this hearing, was to drain Lake Powell, which Congressman Hansen called a very bizarre idea. Mm-hmm. And I think this must have been the reason he wanted to call this hearing, was to show everyone just how crazy this idea was. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because it kind of backfired on him.
Well, it did backfire. Congressman Hansen, who I knew and I really liked, I respected him a great deal. He is a very wonderful person, and he became the chairman of the committee, and he decided to hold this hearing on the proposal from some of the environmental groups that we ought to they referred to it as restoring the canyon, which really meant lowering the lake level and eventually getting rid of the dam entirely. But what happened in the process of giving them a national soapbox to make their case, it kind of turned around on Congressman Hansen and those who ridiculed the environmentalists who came forward on a panel. They spent most of their time ridiculing them. But what happened is a funny thing, and that is that once you start to talk about these issues and you begin to look at them and say, well, what is going on here? Why do we have Glen Canyon Dam? What is its purpose? You begin to understand that much of the myth that surrounds it disappears. And instead of berating and making these folks look pretty foolish, they gave them a national platform and they gained national credibility and a lot of supporters thanks to Congressman Hansen holding those hearings.
You say this idea of removing a dam, which once seemed provocative, is catching on. 1,100 plus dams have been removed in the United States over the years now. And you mentioned that a number of things are going on. We talk about that part. I mean, dam removal, river restoration efforts blooming in Pennsylvania and Virginia and Washington. You mentioned the Elwha River in Washington mm-hmm. State. Two dams on that system have been removed.
Well, what's going on is a recognition that I guess there's several things going on. The first is that any private dam, that's a non-federal dam, that's built either by a utility or a water utility or an electric utility has to be licensed and from the federal government. And as a result of recent legislation, the federal government has to look at the no dam alternative when it reviews the license for these facilities. And suddenly people begin to see that it might make some sense to remove that structure. The second thing that's going on is the insurance industry is waking up and saying, well, hold it. We have all these old dams that are there. They could be potentially dangerous. They could fall down or something could happen. And so we're not going to insure them anymore. So people have to remove them. One of the things that I did to introduce that section of the book is really talk about how people perceive dams.
Yeah.
For some reason, we take great comfort in a dam, this hunk of concrete and rebar across the stream. And once we build a dam and we begin to operate it, we very easily slide that facility into our vocabulary and our geography. It becomes a permanent part of our lives. We put it on our maps and we put it in our vocabulary and we talk about it as if it's going to be there forever. But the thing that most people don't understand is a dam is a temporary structure. And we only put a dam in place because we made a political decision to put it in place. And I think one of the things that people have to realize is we can make a political decision to take it out. And we've done that with quite a few facilities now. As you mentioned, 1,100 dam removal projects underway. Most of those are small dams, but there are a number of large dams. And I've felt for a long time that Glen Canyon Dam just simply doesn't have a contemporary function. It is there. It's there as a result of political wheeling and dealing done in the 1940s and 1950s by a very small number of people. And it was originally built to store water for the upper basin states. Now there isn't, that isn't relevant anymore. It's half empty, less than half empty now. It was built to produce power. It's not producing as much power as it did. And we're within, you know, we can see the point down the road, if the drought continues, that we won't be producing power from Glen Canyon. Well, if it doesn't produce power, it isn't needed for storage, and there are no water is marketed out of that facility, why do you need it? The price of building Glen Canyon Dam is we've destroyed one of the most magnificent canyons in North America, in the world for that matter. Glen Canyon is a magnificent place, and it's a tragedy that we continue to inundate it and flood it. And I think, given the realities of the drought and climate change, Glen Canyon Dam is not going to be a useful component of our federal operating system. And I think we ought to remove it and restore the canyon.
One of the arguments, though, and you sort of mentioned it, it's there. We went through that process. We built it. And so now you have, the impact of you've heard this, tearing down that dam would be, what would the impact be on aquatic systems now in place, the impact on northern Arizona, the Navajo Nation, the economic impact, a loss of some $400 million in revenue. I mean, you've heard all of these things. It would be an eyesore. It could cause air problems, the dust that it would kick up, all of those kinds of things. How do you respond to that, the idea that, okay, maybe it was built on some false assumptions, but it's here. Let's just leave it in place.
My first response to that is, why do we have to live with somebody else's stupid decision? I mean, it really galls me when I hear this argument that, well, it's there and we've got to live with it. No, we don't. We can take it out if we want to. Just because a small number of people made a really stupid decision a few years ago, it doesn't mean we have to live with it. We can make our own decisions for ourselves. The other thing that happens is it's always wonderful when we have these arguments and discussions how people bring up one or two reasons as you know, they as if that was the reason why we shouldn't move in a certain direction. Well, it might cause this, it might cause that. Yes, and 1,000 angels can dance on the head of a pin, too. The point is that we need to sit down and we need to look at it and study it carefully. Will it cause dust problems? I don't think so, but it may, and we ought to look at that. How deep are the sediments? How are we going to move the sediments downstream? There are a lot of questions we need to ask about it, but they're not overwhelming questions. We've done this before. And we're a pretty intelligent people, and we can figure it out.
There, you go through a number of solutions, points to sort of go about dealing with this water crisis. We mentioned the Bureau of Reclamation doing away with that. Here are a few others I wanted you to mention. One of them, of course, is stop delivering subsidized water from federal facilities.
Yeah.
And price water, realistically. So I guess what I would say is, if Utahns, just bring it home here,
sure,
were to pay for the water at the price it's actually costing, what would that mean in terms of lifestyle, in terms of just cost?
Well, it would mean that the cost would be borne by Utahns and not by the federal taxpayers. And that's really the critical issue. Look, we have perpetuated another myth in this country, and that is that water ought to be abundant, it ought to be clean, and it ought to be available so that you can go to any water faucet in America, whether you're in Anchorage, Alaska, or Key West, or you know, Salt Lake City, or Bangor, Maine, and just turn the tap, and water will come out, and that water will be clean and healthy. And we've set that as a national goal and priority, and we've succeeded in it. But when you turn that tap, that water's expensive. It's expensive to capture, move, and deliver. And just how expensive it is borne out if you look at the bottled water industry. 25 years ago, it didn't exist. And nowadays, we don't even bat an eye about paying a dollar for, a bottle of water.
It's more expensive than gas, I think, in some cases.
It is more expensive than yeah, gas.
Yeah.
And so you can get a gallon of gas for, you know, $3 somewhere. You can't get a gallon of water out of your local 7-Eleven. So we have intentionally underpriced water to deliver to our communities. And what we've done is, it's the argument about the Bear River Project here in Utah. The communities want to develop, they want to build reservoirs, and they want to transport water, and they want to deliver it to meet future needs. And the reason they want to do that is, well, they don't want to conserve. They don't want to price water differently. They just want to have water there to meet their needs. Now, that's going to have a severe impact on the resources of northern Utah. And I think we've got to be realistic, water is an essential commodity and ought to be priced at a reasonable rate, and it shouldn't be delivered for free.
You say for hundreds of years we focused on the supply side of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
You want to shift that. This idea of conservation is a big part of the solution that you mentioned too.
Well, conservation and more efficient use and recycling the water that we do use. Those three items are the cheapest, fastest, and most abundant source of water in this country. And we can deliver them much faster. Let's just take the case of the Bear River Project. The Bear River Project probably will take 25 years to develop the first drop of water. By instituting conservation measures, reuse, and more efficient use of water, you can have an impact in 18 months. Well, which is the easiest? Which is the best? It's clearly we ought to go down a different path. I just think so many of our water officials, that's why I say they have their heads stuck in the bottom of an empty reservoir. They would rather build more expensive bathtub rings in the mountains than they would to to say to their constituents, we're going to charge you a fair price for this water, and we're going to try to impose conservation and more efficient use of water.
What's the heart of that, do you think? We want just basic convenience, a sense of materialism, selfishness? I mean, what's... Do you think you've, at this point, understand what's at the heart of that, the human nature part of the equation?
I think it's the analogies go back to energy. You know, 20 years ago, we thought of energy as plentiful and cheap, and that's how we view water. It's plentiful, it's cheap, it'll always be there. Next problem. And I can guarantee you that if you give somebody something for nothing, they aren't going to conserve it and to... protect it. And that's what we're doing with water. We still have this myth running around. One of the things I'm trying to do is say to people, water is very valuable. As the bottled water industry found out, as Coke and Pepsi found out, they're making lots of money now as a result of bottling water, which is really water just out of the tap. But they found out how valuable a commodity that can be. And it's the same with our local utilities that supply our drinking water. And for irrigation districts, too, and for agricultural water use. We need to promote more efficient use of water in the agricultural sector.
Final question. Less than a minute left. You say in your book that 10 years ago you doubted whether the system could be reformed, but you seem pretty optimistic. It seems like there's a lot changed. Social media, the rise of the internet. It seems like this younger generation is very much engaged in this subject. You feel... hopeful at this point?
I'm always upbeat and positive. I'm the eternal optimist, and that's why I wrote the book. I wanted to get a new generation of people excited and interested and get them active. And I am confident that we can make a difference, and we can make a difference rather quickly.
Daniel Beard, author of the book Deadbeat Dams, Why We Should Abolish the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and Tear Down Glen Canyon Dam. Speaking around the state this week, tonight at Ken Sanders Bookshop in Salt Lake City, tomorrow at the University of Utah's Museum of Fine Arts. There's a reading in Moab, a reading in Provo. You can get all of the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Dan Beard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.